This episode of AVXL was recorded on January 4th, 2018. Happy New Year, people! We got the deets on LG's 2018 OLED panels. We're going to talk masking on projection screens, why you can't get Spotify on Ruin, and why I'm so excited about Deep Blue and a little disappointed by Duvalier's Phantom. It's all coming up on AVXL.
Testing 1, 2, 3. All right, I'm not blowing anything out.
Ignorant weasels chewing on your soul. Ignorant weasels. Do you have speed?
Yeah.
Welcome to AVXL, your guide to the best in home theater and audio gear. No matter what your budget is, I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, I am Robert Herron.
I have listened to a lot of glorious audio over the past couple weeks.
That's great, man.
Yeah.
I've been on a video kick, so.
Nothing wrong with that.
Getting caught up on my viewing enjoyment.
I will say I thoroughly enjoyed Netflix Bright.
Oh, cool. I need to go back to Netflix. I've been testing some of the alternative video streaming services. We were talking about Amazon Video. Or Prime Video being available on Android devices last week. And it's nearly useless for me personally because I don't use a Fire TV device and it doesn't play nice with my Chromecast.
I hate that.
So a little less functionality there.
However,
I am really enjoying the Fox Now or app on my Android device that does stream to my Chromecast. And I've been going knee deep into the Orville, the new Seth MacFarlane, Star Trek-like spinoff. And so far, I have to say the humor's pretty good.
Oh, man.
If you're a Trekkie of some kind, I think you would like it. It's definitely not your grandpa's Star Trek, but I appreciate some of the bluntness in terms of the episodes and the dialogue. So
I'm
enjoying that.
Yeah, Bright's never going to make it to the Criterion Collection, but...
okay.
Well, you know what I mean? I got a fair number of those Blu-rays stacked up in my closet. But it was fun. And Will Smith can really act when he wants to. You got...
Yes, he can.
You got the deets. LG dropped the deets on the 2018 LG OLEDs ahead of CES.
Yes.
The big buzz, people were going crazy about the 88-inch 8K OLED prototype, which is nice.
That will be.
May never actually ship. May cost $40 bazillion if it does.
They'll make one for you. If you ask nicely.
Why not buy something that's going to cost vastly more than a spectacular 4K projector?
But still.
With no native content.
I want to say about 10 days ago, I had a pre-brief meeting with them. Right. And they went over basically the lineup for this year. And as of a couple of days ago, some of that information is now public. So we can talk about it. And that includes four new series in the lineup for 2018. The W8, the E8, the C8, and the B8. Looking at March to June 2018 ship dates is what they're claiming currently.
Cool.
No TV in 2018 is going to have HDMI 2.1. The chips weren't ready.
Right.
So, and that applies to LG's latest as well. Big deal, I think, for a lot of people will be having Google Assistant straight up built into these TVs.
I think that's interesting.
And compatibility with Alexa too, but they're claiming that the functionality won't be as comprehensive as they're achieving in terms of being able to control the device and little things that you may be able to do versus on Google Assistant versus having Alexa compatibility. So one of the more interesting aspects of the whole lineup is the fact that the more affordable, typically you think of the B and the C series, be it from 2017 or 2018 or even 2016, those are generally the more affordable panels of their lineup. You compare that to like the W series, that wallpaper.
Right.
For the C series for 2018, they're adding a 77-inch screen size. So, number one, if you wanted to go bigger, but the pricing has been, to say the least, you're talking five figures for one of those TVs. Let's hope that the C series 77-inch offering will get that price down into something closer to what maybe the LCD guys are challenging with in their premium offerings. In a return to things past, one difference among the panel lineup for this year is the chipset differences. They have returned. Last year for 2017, one beauty of the LG lineup, for the most part, was a consistent chipset across all panels. Didn't matter if you bought their least expensive or their most expensive, you were getting similar video processing capabilities, similar just functionality in terms of what can be done on the panel itself from series to series. Now, with the 2018 lineup, it looks like The B series will receive, instead of the Alpha 9 processor that they're touting for all their high-end products, the higher-end OLEDs at least, this A7 processor is going to be exclusively for the B8. And if you think about what they did with the B7 series for 2017, that started off being identical to the rest of the lineup, but by the end of its run, they had created a variant that took away Dolby Atmos decoding. On the 2018 lineup, that most affordable B8 is going to have a different processor, and one of its limitations will be that when it's displaying 4K content, the two new features that are going to be incorporated into the series for LG televisions and others too will be high frame rate and HDR support, of course. And unfortunately, with the A7 processor and the B8, it's kind of a one or the other. You can do high frame rate or you can do high dynamic range in 4K, but you can't do both simultaneously. And the remaining members of LG's 2018 lineup that use that Alpha 9 processor, they can actually do not only 4K HDR, but high frame rate as well, up to 120 frames per second. Now, there is no content currently available in 120 frames per second, be it disc or streaming or whatever. So it's going to start off with streaming content first, of course. And you consider the lack of HDMI 2.1, that just kind of nails it down in the sense of there isn't going to be an external source device you're going to be able to plug into these TVs that is going to be able to provide high dynamic range plus frame rates up to 120 frames per second over an existing connection on these TVs. We're going to have to wait for something like HDMI 2.1. So while internally the TV is capable, at least as far as the C8, the E8, and the W8, those will be compatible with high frame rate sources when they become available. Mm-hmm. And they'll be able to do that while displaying high dynamic range at the same time, unlike the B8 that simply can do one or the other. It would seem to be a lack of bandwidth within that particular chipset. And again, they are saying, sources that be, that there will be streaming content available, looking to do at least 4K 120. I'll be curious to see what kind of demos they'll provide with that and who the streaming providers will be that will get that first, be able to deliver that first. That's a heck of a lot of data. And if you consider the current state of UHD Blu-ray, there are a couple titles out there that are encoded as 4K 60. One being Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk that was originally shot at 120 frames per second. And I believe you could actually see it at that insane frame rate the theater. But when it comes to the Blu-ray encode, the UHD Blu-ray encode anyway, that was 2 4K 60, which still looks oddly smooth and oddly crisp, but but as far as, you know, what content we'll be able to see on these new panels coming up, well, to do HDR and HFR simultaneously, you're looking at least the C series or above. We're talking all 4K resolution still, the W being the wallpaper model that's magnetically attached to the wall, the picture on glass design of the E8, and what they call the slim blade designs of the C and the B series. So
slim blade,
you still get that killer thin screen design with the emissive quality of an OLED with its terrific viewing angles and, generally speaking, terrific out-of-the-box color. This simply is going to break it up a little bit in terms of that oddball chipset. Not oddball, but the A7 processor used in the B8. I'll be curious to see if that really, if it in any way changes the picture quality compared to the other series. So
that would be nice.
I'm looking forward to it. I'll have more details about these TVs, especially when we get to CES. There are a few things that should prove interesting for calibrators or people interested in very, very perfected picture quality out of these systems. So I'm looking forward to reporting on that when I get there. I'll also be curious to see it and nail down more so if they're actually using any of the new OLED materials that have been materializing in the last couple of months. TADF was something we talked about, basically a way to create the materials that actually glow with fewer rare resources and to make them even better performing, especially on the blue color that can age differently than the red and the green. So there are some technical advantages. I'm curious to see if they've integrated. But for right now, what we have is the W, the E, the C, and the B returning for 2018 in the form of the 8 series panels. No G panel. Kind of interesting. I think they're simplifying things a little bit there.
I'm okay with that.
Yeah, that was
Yeah, that was probably a big lesson for them as people figured out
the folding soundbar design.
Well, yeah, it's also the later we got into 2017, the more people knew that you were essentially getting the same, you know, panel and processor across all these different models. And I think, I don't know, I'm all for simplifying lineups.
No problem there. For the most part, too, you figure the most important thing being the larger screen size coming to that C8 series.
Right.
That will hopefully get the price under $8,000. Yeah. Yeah, still.
I laugh because, you know, I read an article a few weeks ago where the average television, the average TV, the average HDTV, average 4K TV in the United States sells for under $700.
Oh.
Like 10% of them cost more than $1,000, and the median price there is $1,100 or $1,300.
Until you get into the 60 and above, yeah. Or above 60 inches. And then it targets really close to about $1,700, which was right about where LG was targeting their entry-level 65-inch or 55-inch OLED.
I've only said this like 17 times in the last 3 weeks, but I'm really curious to see what TCL comes out with this year.
Yeah.
And, of course, we're also curious to, you know, Samsung has been mum.
They have been... They've relatively quiet about what they're up to.
It's because they're going to introduce something amazing that changes the game.
I think it's going to be a combination of many things. Similar to really what LG did last year, going from the 2016 to the 2017 OLEDs, they did many little things that added up to just a much improved package.
Right.
And with Samsung, as far as LCD technology goes, I have hints to say that they are doing something similar in terms of what are all the little quirks that we can iron out further. What are the main tripping points as far as are that type of display technology versus something like an OLED, and what can they deliver that maybe OLED can't? And
more news on this next week.
Unfortunately, unlike LG, who just kind of did the dump on what's coming up a little early.
Yeah, we'll fire out a podcast as soon as we can next week.
Samsung's still a little mum.
Because it's a big press day for televisions next week.
It's going to be cool. I don't see anything dramatically different with the 2018 OLEDs from LG. The new processing is going to be interesting.
Right.
Although 4K 120 input is, except for maybe a PC, you're not going to do that over an HDMI connection anyway. However, over a regular HDMI connection to a TV like this, you could do something like 1080p 120. No problem. There are also aspects, too, of how the pictures are being generated with these OLEDs. One way they could improve the appearance of motion resolution or being more detailed is to either increase the frame rate of these TVs or to do something like a black frame insertion. Mm-hmm. Every other frame being a blacked out frame, which gives your eye a second to reset and to be able to better process fast-moving content in terms of seeing detail without smearing or other artifacts that might be related to that. OLEDs already are so fast in terms of per pixel adjustments and in terms of luminance changes and things like that. There is generally no smearing, but because of the way that type of display it is, where it flashes an image, holds it there, and then it doesn't change it until the next frame hits the signal path. Unlike TVs or even plasmas or other things like that, the old tube TVs anyway, where it was very impulse driven, those seem to just be better for our eyes in terms of just making content less pronounced. And I'm hoping that these new LG OLEDs are actually pushing true 240 hertz performance internally, and then they could do some pretty interesting things beyond that. But that is one thing I have not confirmed yet. Everyone's talking about 120 frames per second, but internally, is that actually perhaps a 240 hertz panel?
We'll find out.
Yeah. Do I get my black frame insertion? I hope so.
Oh, my goodness. So a few weeks ago, a friend of mine sent home one of Duvalier's Phantoms with me. He'd had trouble configuring it. Was like, just play with this. And I was like, okay, you want to hand me a $2,000 wireless speaker, I'll play with it. You know, and so I started working on a review of it. And frankly, after having spent a bunch of quality time working on a review of Duvalier's Phantom, the space helmet, it's got the big fat aluminum woofers. I want to say they debuted in like 2015. And Duvalier's an interesting company. They're French. They kind of made their bones doing these incredible DAC preamp amplifier combinations where they'd basically do the digital analog conversion, send that into a Class A amplifier, which is the silky smooth, always powered amplifier that audiophiles love so much as a preamp, and then running that through a digital amplifier. And these sell for like $9,000. You get this big chrome pizza box full of audio goodness, right? So by Duvalier's standards, $2,000 for a wireless speaker is, pretty reasonable. And
yes.
And they got a huge amount of press, right? Because they were claiming at the time it was going down to 14 hertz. I think they now say 16 hertz. You know, the current version of the entry-level model, they did a software bump, so it's like 1,200 watts. They dropped the price down to $1,690. The more I played around with it, the more I started thinking about two things. Is like, wow, for a lot less than this, I can get a pair of Sonos Play Ones and a Sonos Sub, and I will have stereo imaging. And yes. I got to say, the Play Ones sound pretty fantastic. And I also started thinking about a product I've seen from Peachtree. And Peachtree does some really sweet, stylish amplifiers. But they did a wireless speaker called the Deep Blue. And then a couple years ago, I saw Deep Blue 2. And then at Rocky Mountain Audio Fest, just this past fall, they had a demo of the Deep Blue 3. And the Deep Blue 3, now, you know, if you are obsessed with specs and comparing numbers of stuff you haven't heard, it's only 450 watts and it only covers 40 hertz to 20,000 hertz, which is only the vast majority of the audio listening spectrum. And I started thinking, like, you know, you can pick up a pair of Deep Blue speakers and get some pretty impressive stereo imaging and a lot of thump, you know, for a lot less than a single Devalier speaker, which is going to be a single point source. And I will say,
They do have the silver and the gold Phantom kits.
Oh my goodness! I got to say, the stands for the Phantoms are possibly my favorite part.
I think they look adorable.
They are really cool. You know,
it's got to be the most interesting 2.1 speaker setup I've seen in a while.
Well, it's two. It's either one or two. There is no subwoofer option on that one, but in theory, you don't need it, right?
I should say not 2.1, but that what they call their stereo? Dialogue. Intelligent hub.
Yeah, let's not get into that. Because if you have one of the earliest generation speakers, you actually need to pay another $300-something for the Dialogue hub if you want to have two of them in stereo.
Oh.
After you spend, you know, $3,700. Well, if you have the new ones, don't get me into that.
It just, I'll let it go.
Money is something you spend freely in the Phantom universe.
Understood.
But
it looks good.
You know, so I've only heard Deep Blue 2 and Deep Blue 3 at Rocky Mountain Audio Fest. But, you know, something I was thinking about is it seems a little less bloated in the bass and a little less shrill in the treble. If you have a bright room, if you have a lot of hard surfaces in your room, to my ears, Devalier's Phantom is a little too much in the high end. It's a little, you know, it's a little
crispy,
fatiguing. Yeah. You know, and it's tuned like they want to make sure it's tuned the way televisions are tuned for the big box stores. Out of the box, right? Your televisions are all set because they never know which one's going to be on the rack at Costco or Best Buy. So everything comes out in vivid mode and it's stupid bright and you get a suntan while you're looking at it at Costco. And the Devalier's tuning reminds me of that. It's a little heavy on the high end, a little heavy on the low end. But you can't actually tune it for your room or your EQ.
Oh.
For example, with, you know, Sonos's Play system, you can walk around the room with your phone and tune it, have it adjust for the room conditions, right? So I mentioned Deep Blue 3. Peachtree sold out of the Deep Blue 2 last year. So I asked, like, you know, when's the Peachtree, the Deep Blue 3 going to come out? And they said it's basically in transit. So it's on a ship somewhere.
Excellent.
Or they are on a ship somewhere. Should be available for sale by the end of the month. We'll list it on Amazon.com and then available in March after that. And the COO talked to me. He said, sonically, it's identical to the Deep Blue 2, which is fantastic as far as I'm concerned. They put in a newer Bluetooth chip, a newer antenna design, and they're basically saying they've taken the wireless range for Bluetooth from 30 feet to 80 feet. Now, if you're a person who's like, I can't do Bluetooth audio, that's fine. Because they also said they're working on a new Wi-Fi Deep Blue product called the Deep Blue Sky. So instead of Bluetooth, it's going to offer Wi-Fi. And they'll have an app to interface it with your smartphone. And they said they packed a better amplifier into it that's cleaner sounding, even less noise than the amp used in the DB2 or 3. The DB3, the Deep Blue 3 is going to cost $400. The Deep Blue Sky is going to cost $500. So not exactly cheap. But
it sounds like solid improvements.
Yeah, and
stuff you would want.
Yeah, and I gotta say this is I think you can do some fine listening with this, and I think it's loud enough to go into party mode. And while I'd rather it went to 30 hertz or 20 hertz, quite frankly, 40 hertz is where the vast majority of the speakers I've seen lately are kind of ending. You know, there are speakers, full size speakers that go to 20 hertz, but unlike the, and I will say from a engineering perspective, the Duvalier Phantom is amazing. There's like over 100 patents involved in it. It's hermetically sealed. It is a spectacular piece of work.
In terms of trying to flatten out the response for its given size.
Well, and that's the thing, right? It's an amazing piece of hardware, but the software for the Phantom kind of sucks. It's kind of miserable. I can't wait to hear the Deep Blue Sky. And I got to say, if you're into the styling, the Phantom is gorgeous.
Yeah.
You know, they have a $2,990 version, the gold version that packs, quote, I'm just going to say this, 4,500 watts and what I will affectionately call an ear-destroying top volume of 108 decibels.
How?
That's literally, you crank it up to max, you're probably going to permanently damage your hearing within minutes, period. That's too loud. Most people are never going to turn it up that loud. But when you look at the Phantom, right, if you want stereo imaging, and I want stereo imaging, there is a lot to be gained from, you know, playing back stereo recordings across two speakers. You're talking $3,400 to $6,000, depending on whether you get the entry level, the silver, or the gold from Duvalier. Personally, I would say look at Kef's LS50 wireless. They're $2,200 a pair. Those Peachtree Deep Blue speakers. Apparently, like I said at the beginning, a pair of Sonos Play 1 and a Sonos Sub. A pair of Play 1s and a Sonos Sub will set you back $1,000.
Better values.
Yeah.
But if you really like the Phantom design, which, I mean,
and you have a boatload of money.
Yes. You're paying for it. But yeah. Is there anything technically you would say negative about it than the pricing?
Well, the pricing, and look, you know, I'm somebody
who can get comparative stuff for less.
I can look at Mr. Speakers, you know, a set of Mr. Speakers Aeon headphones and be like, for $800, these are a bargain.
Totally.
But, you know, people look at me like I'm on crack. I'm like, but, you know, these $20,000 pair of speakers or, you know, what would be a $1,500 to $4,000 set of headphones, an $800 set of headphones suddenly is kind of a bargain by comparison, right? The thing that really kind of blew my mind was how not easy to the Aeon, Mr. Speaker's Aeon. Did I call him Ether or did I call him Aeon?
I think you said Aeon.
Okay. A-E-O-N, Aeon. Fantastic. MrSpeakers.com. Check them out. If you can listen to them, they're amazing. But the thing kind of, you know, I haven't run the Peachtree software. We don't know how it's going to work. But Duvalier, their Spark app, they need to take notes from Kef. They need to take notes from Sonos. And I can understand why maybe like this is our tuning and we will not let the end user change it, which I think is kind of silly for if you're going to drop $1,700 on a speaker.
All right. That's a better point there.
You know what
I mean? The one that kind of solidifies for me. I'd probably be looking something more towards Sonos just with my given history with it and to use, like you said, the app on the phone
as
a way to just do a good room setup for a given environment.
Yeah.
Easily is it's got to be. Yeah. It's not a bad thing at all.
If you got a lot of couches and curtains and, you know, fabric-y wallpaper, I bet the Phantoms probably sound better than they do. I'll be very curious to hear Peachtree's Deep Blue in my listening room to see whether it seems as harsh and to see what options they do in that. But, man, you know, amazing piece of engineering. I would love Duvalier to catch up on the software on that one.
There you go.
Oh, my goodness. Random thought. The world's shortest AV 101. Never buy anything right before CES unless it's a crazy deal on something used. I'm just saying.
Totally. There's going to be good deals out there.
Yeah.
And like we're talking about, too, for the TVs that'll be coming out in 2018, we're months away from seeing stuff. So
good point.
If you need something now, there are good deals to be had.
Yeah.
Shop carefully.
Shop carefully.
Yeah. I don't think if you bought a TV today, value or premium, it's not going to become immediately outdated come next week.
Good point. It shouldn't be that angry.
No.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'm talking about digital audio. A couple people have asked me, why doesn't Rune Labs support Spotify? And I'm talking about RoonLabs.com, not the open source Rune Audio that you put on a Raspberry Pi.
Yeah.
And it turns out it's not because Rune Labs, the front end for your digital audio collection and title, is too cool for Spotify and its 300K compressed audio. You know, I'd searched around. I thought I'd searched everywhere on Spotify's forums. But Rune Labs COO, Danny Delai, Mr. Delai, I hope I said that properly, basically said that Spotify shut them down. He said, and this was back in 2015, he said they'd have to spoof being the official client to be a headless Spotify client. But if they do that, Spotify will shut them down. They basically, Spotify will break it. And so that the issue is not with Rune, it is with Spotify and how Spotify sets it up. There's also an issue, he pointed out, that, you know, Tidal gives them access to a lot of the back end stuff. And I'm going to use a highly technical term, stuff there. And what's if you've never looked at the Rune Labs website, you know, what it, their idea is, you know, you take your tablet, you run their software on there, you index your zillions of audio files stored in your server, stored in your hard drive that you share, and it pulls together the album artwork and information, and it gives you a much more complete experience. And it's a really nice, like, I hate running Tidal. I like running Tidal in the Rune Lab software.
Oh, okay.
I like running the Rune Lab software for my music collection. I really wish Spotify, which I think has a better collection of audio, but, you know, Spotify doesn't need Rune Labs as much because Spotify has a much better front end. I also want to say it's going to be curious to see where Tidal is in a few months because there have been some articles recently that have suggested that Tidal is running out of money. But I just wanted to talk about the whole Spotify thing there.
Done and done.
Andrew writes, I'm finally building my home theater, and I had a quick question on projector screens. I'm trying to decide between a retractable screen or a fixed screen with four-way masking. If you get a masking screen, do I need a special projector? I was looking at getting a Sony VPLH W45ES. Would that work with something like Stuart Filmscreen's Ultimate Formway Scream Wall or Reference X Mask? Is masking worth it if I'm not using an anamorphic lens? Your Patreon supporter, Andrew. First up, thank you for your support on Patreon. We really appreciate that. Patreon.com/AVXL. If you want to be part of the crew that supports the show, Patreon.com/AVXL. If I'm talking too fast.
No, thank you. Thank you to everyone who's supported us and keeping the show humming along.
I mean, as somebody who's currently shopping for a new retractable screen and will be, you know, haunting certain booths at CES as part of that, and we'll report next week. Masking screens are expensive. And they go from slightly too expensive to, oh, sweet Jesus, I could buy a pretty good car for the cost of that masking screen. And the idea, right, if you've never heard of masking, the sides come in if you're doing a 4x3 projection for classic films, if you've got like 2:35:1 wide screen, the top and bottom, like basically black Dubatine light-absorbing fabric slides up and slides down, and it covers all the reflective screen that's not being actively projected onto, which is kind of like a complete sentence.
And the simplest ones I see are two-way masking screens where generally, say the screen is without any masking, would be 16:9 in terms of its shape, its aspect ratio. And then by simply enlarging the upper and the lower black bars, the screen's matting, you're able then to create a narrower aspect ratio, like 2:40:1 or a CinemaScope or, you know, one of the wider 2:35:1, however you like. And that's one way to have two screens out of literally one setup. And then that all that would require at that point would be to have a compatible projector that would enable lens presets to where you can then specify. It's like, hey, when the content's detected at 2:35:1, retract or extend the mats along the screen edges to do that accordingly.
We talked about some of the examples of this we saw at Cedia earlier this year that were, you know, not as, because when you're talking about a four-way masking, you're talking about stuff that comes up from the bottom, stuff that comes down from the top, stuff that comes in from the sides. It takes up a lot of space. It costs a lot of money. And we saw some simpler stuff that maybe wouldn't mask for 4x3, but would certainly adjust between a traditional 16:9 or 2:35:1.
And even at Cedia, too, we saw some companies that simply, they used a rolling storage system or a rolled storage system for the screen material for it. And like Screen Innovations, they have one product we looked at called the Zero G, which effectively the whole screen comes down on a set of wires and then it unfurls at that point. And just by simply adjusting how much the screen unfurled or not, that gave you that basic aspect ratio control.
That was really slick. That was one of the more impressive things we saw.
The most expensive ones I see are the true four-way masking screens that can literally adjust from being a 4x3 aspect ratio display up to 16:9, 240, 2:35, 2:40:1. Yeah. And Stuart Film Screen and others make amazing versions of that kind of technology. And just to throw it back at Screen Innovations again, they do actually have a fixed frame system called the Transformer. I have to say, it's kind of clever in the way they do it. That's taking that rolled film or the rolled screen material and a cool sliding mat system along the side. So basically the frame is expandable in a couple of directions. So it's just a way to kind of hide the necessary mechanics
right.
for creating a screen that can adjust its aspect ratio to the content. The main reason to even do any of this is so that you have better contrast performance on mm-hmm. what the content you're looking at. So that the...
And it's pretty.
Yes.
I'm going to say that. I mean, aesthetically, if you have the money to set something like this, like as somebody who's never had masking on a projection screen in their home... You know you're in a really amazing home, or should be, you know, in a pretty amazing home theater experience if everything's being masked and everything goes black. That's not the picture. And
totally,
it is
when your video content fills your screen, a projection screen, fully,
yeah.
with no unused white portions of the screen still visible. One question we get a lot is how you actually control these devices, and a lot of them have still serial controls related to every masking screen I look at has at least the basic presets built into it.
Well, Stuart, like if you do the four-way variable masking system, right, they have their brick,
glorious.
The binary reciprocal intelligent controller. It does awesome. RS-232, RS-422, Cat5. You can do screen trigger interfaces using 18-gauge wire, because apparently some projectors are set up so they actually have a wired connection that triggers the ratio on the screen.
Handy.
They have keypad interfaces, external IR interfaces, you know, and then they can give you an IR remote, you know, remote control that's preset with 16x9, 4x3, and 185. Something you talked about, like this is not going to change fast enough for stuff like The Dark Knight, where they do crazy aspect ratio changes in the screen. This is something you do in between. Like if you switch from like, I've just watched The Third Man or some other piece of classic cinema, and now I'm going to be watching, you know, some crazy widescreen thing or you know, The Dark Knight.
Or what is it? Like The Big Lebowski is in, I think it's not 16x9, but it almost perfectly fills that frame. And then switch to a traditional widescreen movie. It's just nice to have the screen automatically change for that for the given content.
Yeah. I mean, the short version is like, look, you know, do you need a special projector? You know, it's more of an issue of figuring out how you're going to make all of this stuff work together.
I would, at the very least, I'd be looking at projectors that had motorized lenses and then presets. You're going to need presets to make this work effectively. Otherwise, you're going to be manually adjusting your projector every time.
And you don't want to do that.
No. That will not work over the long run. So,
you're going to have to put together time to get over Projector Central, put together a short list of projectors that do presets. You're going to have to take a look at the cost of the screens and the controllers, whether or not you can implement that yourself or if you're willing to pay for an installer to do that.
That Sony projector, I want to say, doesn't have lens presets either. It's arguably my absolute favorite value 1080p projector from Sony, but I do not believe it has. I mean, it's got all your basics like manual zoom lens, vertical horizontal lens shift, other features like that, but I simply do not believe it has the motorized focus for the lens, which of course not, but also just the ability to then change the zoom levels to get say two different aspect ratios to work within your setup. So that might not be the best, even though I love that projector, I don't think that's the best one to be considering for what you're trying to do, especially if you're trying to automate this in any way.
I'm going to say this. I would not want to have, in my particular environment, because I do not have a dedicated room just for home theater, I would definitely get a retractable screen. I have never in like close to a decade of using a projector, I've never thought to myself, you know, this movie wouldn't have sucked if I'd masked, you know, if I'd letterboxed it or if I...
That's true too. And I mean... I've pointed projectors at walls and they still look great.
Yeah.
You know, the experience is the experience, but if you're really trying to optimize everything and to make it look fantastic.
We are down with you doing this. Just understand that, you know, you're going to have to get the right projector. You're going to have to configure this and you're going to have to make everything work. And you're probably going to cut some fairly extensive checks in the process. Extensive? Large.
Large.
Oh my goodness. Normally we'd be talking about what we're watching right now, but we're going to do kind of a short episode this week because... We are buried under gazillions of emails from PR folks for CES.
Come look at my stuff.
I have shiny objects.
Oh.
And so, next week we'll have the news, more information from LG, Samsung, TCL. Man, I've got, I'm going to see.
I'm going to be hanging with the Hisense peeps, see what they're
goodness.
Up to. Yeah. Everyone's putting Alexa in their TVs. I'm seeing Alexa in everything. So.
I picked up a Google Home Mini and an Echo
Spot.
Just
do you have them hooked up?
Just barely.
Okay.
It's there's A lot of quality family time, and we got a new dog for my wife's birthday on New Year's Eve. So it detracted from my time to play around with voice control systems. But the idea of talking to the thing and having the music come up is kind of fascinating to me.
That, or just to walk in a room and say, turn on the TV.
Something. It's so Star Trek.
I mean, it's the freaking future, people. It's awesome.
Speaking of the freaking future, AVXL.com is the place to find all of our episodes and how to subscribe. Patreon.com/AVXL is where we'd like you to head out or head over to if you'd like to become a sponsor to help become a patron of the show to help us pay the bills and give us a little money for our time. Ask@AVXL.com is the place to send your questions. And please tweet at Robert Hammer and
That guy too.
Tweet at Robert Heron, at Patrick Norton, or at AVXL if you've got questions about CES. And we're going to try to do a podcast from CES if we can make it work. And seriously, tweet us or email ask@AVXL.com if you see something interesting or hear something interesting and you want to see if we can get our eyeballs on it. I mean, yeah, I'm going to go see Definitive Audio, Emotiva, Vandersteen. The crew from AKM is going to be there with Dax.
It's going to be a good year for AV, man.
Yeah. I'm really curious to see what TCL does. So, and there will be headphones.
And calibration technologies to explore on my end that I am
FIO's going to be every. Excited. Lots of people are going to be there.
I'd be curious if anybody's rolling out any kind of new calibration sensor. That's something else I've been meaning to get back into as well, just to find something affordable for people if they want to do their own, you know, white balance and color adjustments on their TV. What can be done without breaking the bank? And I will have the attention of the groups responsible for some of that great software and hardware, and I will be sure to pummel them appropriately.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for spending the time with us to listen to AVXL and our musings on the world of video and audio. And please come check us out next week, avxl.com, and we're out. I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, I'm Robert Heron.
We'll catch you next week from CES.